after the
thawing down.
I just wonder how.
I'll just put it here. And the carcass should be in the room somewhere.
Okay.
Otherwise, maybe
not. Once you get started.
Thank you.
Okay, so
yeah.
I mean, you have a lot of horse anyways.
What
do
you say? I'm allowed to see it. Yeah.
So I'm just going to do an intro thing. So
beautiful.
Maybe you're ready. I'll have to think like a great.
Can you hear me? Wonderful. Okay, welcome everybody. Brochim Abayim. It's great to welcome you here to the 5th International Conference in Jewish Medical Ethics. For those that have been here before, we hope that you will be pleased that we will continue what we have already done for several years in offering really an outstanding weekend in terms of scholarship, understanding, and learning together. For those that are new for the first time here, we welcome you, of course. Hope you enjoy yourself at the weekend and the location, and hopefully the weather will cooperate. That's the one area that, as much as we'd like to say that we'd like to take care of everything, we can't do that. So, God willing, we'll be able to make that as well. We have a very wonderful program planned. If you haven't picked them up yet, just a couple of tidbits of introduction. For those of you that are physicians, or for non-physicians, if you need to have any sort of credit ascribed and you need some sort of certificate, please register. At the conclusion on Sunday, we will be providing the CME credits for those that have signed up. Along the way, you will hear the broken record again over and over. Please fill out your evaluations and surveys. They really help us. They help us in many ways in terms of planning, so that we could get some sense of what it is people would like to hear, what is the type of topics for the future, and sections that deal with were the cookies too hard, or were they too soft, and et cetera, and the other things like that. So those are all part of that. If there's anything that we can do to help you, Jay and I and the staff here would try our best that we can. Needless to say, a program like this does not just happen, you know, in a vacuum. So great thanks to the Torah in Motion staff back home in Toronto, and to Rabbi Kelman and Ilana Kelman for really doing a lot of the slugging along the way. So I'd like to thank them. It's been a pleasure to do this now for the fifth year, and the Mirza Shem, we hope to continue. We will be introducing our speakers over as they come to us one at a time, but as a general rule in terms of the speakers that we have been able that have visited with us in the past and that have some of our newcomers today, outstanding in terms of their academia, their publishing, their scholarship, and the type of physicians and speakers that we have are really, you know, world class. So I hope not only will you get a chance to just hear them over the weekend, but I hope you actually get a chance between sessions to engage with them. They are very approachable and really a gem of information that one can learn from them. To kick off the program, I would like to share with you a brief thought, just to put at least this weekend into some perspective. I'm sure everybody here comes with a different idea, different perspective. Some of you are here kicking and dragged by your spouse who wants to be here, and some people are nodding, and some of you are here for the lectures. But no matter what, there will be something I hope for everybody this weekend. But in particular, I want to I'm reminded by a story. It's a story that many of you have heard, or it's a rather famous story, at least in some circles. And it's the story of the student who comes to Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner was the dean of the Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. He's the Rosh Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. And the student was troubled by this notion that he was facing the real world, and he was having to contemplate what is known as the double life. He was struggling with this idea. How does he have to go out to the real world where he professes to work in one venue, And then in the other venue, he is the embodies Judaism, its precepts, its following. And how does he blend this together? And he was very confronted. And to some extent, I suppose we all are. Rav Kotler had, I think, what is a wonderful parable, and he basically identified to the students a misguidance in his thought. There's basically two approaches. One is the hotel and the room that you rent. So the hotel and the room that you rent is, I live in a hotel, I live in one place, I rent another room, and I go back and forth between the two worlds. Rav Kotler suggested that the world that we live in is a large house, and there are multiple rooms within the house. And we move from within this house, from room to room. And in so doing, there is a seamless progression, but we are still in that house. And I think this conference really embodied that notion, that whether we are physicians, whether we are PAs, whether we are in the nursing field, whether we are psychologists, whatever field that we are in, we do encounter the world. And part of our objective is to meet up with this world and try to sort of keep it under the roof of one house, albeit by moving from room to room. So I think that for myself and for some of the, it's a thought as we move through some of the challenging difficulties we will be dealing with. This evening is a very general approach, and it's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who in the past has set the tone beautifully for us with this sort of year-in-review type of an opening lecture. Tonight we will be hearing a general review, and then tomorrow, as you can follow through in your books, we will be getting into some of the details, rolling up our sleeves and getting our hands soiled. Rabbi Reichman is now, I'm happy to say, a professor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And he's a professor of emergency medicine and a professor in the Division of Education and Bioethics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University. He teaches Jewish medical ethics. He has been very involved in teaching medical students. He has been extremely involved in general in teaching medicine. In addition, he has received his rabbinic ordination from what is known as REITS, that is the Rabbinical School of Yeshiva University, and he has lectured internationally. If I were to continue with his CV, it would take too much time and it would short his lecture. But above all, it's a pleasure to welcome him back, his smiley face and his tremendous knowledge, Rabbi Reichman.
Good evening, everybody. An absolute pleasure, schuss, to be here back at the Torah in Motion Annual Medical Ethics Conference, which has really become, was always, but continues to expand in its breadth, and is truly an extraordinary conference. Every year, they bring in speakers of international renown. Rabbi Jay and Dr. Laser should be commended. They do an extraordinary amount of work for literally every minute of the program, every second of the program, every detail of the program. I think we should give them a tremendous round of applause. Two astronauts landed on Mars. Their mission? To check if there's oxygen on the planet. Give me the box of matches, says one. Either it burns and there is oxygen, or nothing happens. He takes the box, is ready to strike a match, when out of the blue, a Martian comes and starts screaming, "No, no, don't do that!" and grabs the match away. Two guys look at each other. Could there be an unknown explosive gas on Mars? But he takes another match. And as he takes out the other match, all of a sudden, hundreds of Martians come. And they say, "No, no, don't do that!" And the astronaut turns to his buddy and he says, "Listen." And he turns to the other Martians. Said, "I want you to know, we are here in the name of science. We are going to light this match no matter what because we have to figure out what happened." But he lights the match quickly, and the match lights, and it burns down, and nothing happens. And he turns to the Martians. He says, "Why are you so worried about lighting the match? What's the problem?" So the Martian turns to him and says, "Because today is Shabbos." More apropos, perhaps, for Dr. Kadish's lecture about the impact of the Jews on discovery. But what we're going to talk about is the world of discovery today, This has become an annual lecture, the annual Medical Aloha Update, where we update the both the news items and the fascinating discoveries over the past year. Usually we would have a laser pointer. In lieu of a modern laser pointer, we will have the age-old laser pointer. I actually apologize. I'm going to come in front of the podium, if that's okay. Very good. So I begin with my analog slide. This slide is a slide that I like to begin this lecture with every year, and as you'll see in a moment, the relevance and why it's so important. Most of what we will be discussing during this conference, there will be many halakhic sources. This particular lecture, well, of course, it has a number of halakhic sources, will primarily be discussing scientific information and the scientific developments. And one would think that perhaps this would be a bittul Torah, and one perhaps should not be engaging just in scientific discussion. So apropos that, I share with you the following Mishnah from Pirkei Avos. Shimon Omer HaMahalik Vadeach Vashona U'mafsik Mimishna Sova Omer Manoa Ilon Zeh. Person is in the midst of learning, they're walking and they're carrying their sefer with them, and they pick up their eyes from the sefer and they look at the magnificent scenery of Lake Placid. They say, how spectacular is this scenery? What does the Mishnah say? It says, Ma'alel of Akosu Ki'ilu Mishkai Benasha. This person's committed a capital crime. He's guilty of committing a capital crime. So the question is, why? So the simple understanding is, you shouldn't stop learning. One should never stop learning. But Rav Shimshon of Paul Hirsch says a different idea, which is very relevant to this entire conference, and of course this particular session as well. And he says, the key aspect of this Mishnah, and why the person is guilty, is because when he stops, he is learning in the midst of learning, he stops his learning, and says, this magnificent scenery that I see, this world that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, has absolutely nothing to do with the Gemara that I'm reading, with the Chumash that I'm reading, with the Mishnah that I'm reading. And when the person states that, and doesn't appreciate that the two are intertwined, doesn't appreciate that his appreciation of the science and nature and the understanding of the human body, and all the more so, Manoa Ilon Zeh, we say, other Meitzafadeh, that a person is considered to be like a tree himself, and understand the anatomy, the physiology, and the pathology, and the cures, and the treatments, and he doesn't understand that this is part of his learning, then indeed, Ma'alel of Akasim Kiyo Nishai Benasha. That person is indeed guilty of a crime. And I think the people in this room appreciate the validity and veracity of the beautiful words of Rav Shimshon Kol Hirsch, Rav Laser. There are many fascinating halakhic chapters of the past, including the use of the mummies for medicinal purposes, smallpox, which we'll actually talk about briefly today, autopsy back in the 18th century. But we've come quite far from that. And moving into the contemporary era, we have magnificent works in the field of contemporary medical halacha. The one in the upper left, of course, from our own Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, who had, for all of us here, had the tremendous bliss of having him here at this conference for a number of years, as well as Rabbi Bleich and Dr. Rosner and Dr. Abraham and Rabbi Tendler, who've all contributed bountifully to the contemporary field of medical halacha. But as we move forward, I think we need to take a different approach to the field of medical halacha. The classic approach to medical halacha, to all halacha, in fact, is reactive. And in fact, the seminal sefer of the halachic literature is the Tshuva Svarim, the Shailos and Tshuva Svarim, where questions are asked and responses are given. The problem with this is that if we wait for the questions to be asked, in the field of medical halacha, where the advances are so rapid, we will already be behind the eight ball. So in that vein, or in that artery, if you will, I have created the fictional journal called the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha. And what this journal is it looks at the new developments and begins discussions about what the halachic ramifications are of these developments. We begin with the beginning of life and we move forward towards the end of life. We all know that three out of the four Imahos suffer from infertility. Sarah, Imenu, suffered from infertility. There's actually an interesting debate about what the medical cause was of her infertility. according to some, if you read the first pasuk from Bereishis, Vatehi Sarai Akara Ein La Valad, and Rashi says that Sarai was barren, she had no valad. Valad can be interpreted as no child or no fetus. But Rashi says, Afilu Beit Valad Ein La, that she didn't even have a womb. She didn't even have a uterus. The other midrashic line about why Sarah was infertile is because Chadal Yos L'Sarah Orach Kanashim. She was postmenopausal. And what is fascinating is that whichever one of these two would have been the cause of Sarah's infertility, had Sarah and Menu lived today, there could have been potential treatment for those. Here's an absolutely fascinating entry. Scientists rewrite rules of human reproduction. The first human egg cells that had been grown entirely in the laboratory from stem cells could be fertilized later this year in a development that will revolutionize fertility treatments and may even lead to a reversal of the menopause in older women. Some scientists are even suggesting the possibility of producing an elixir of youth for women where the menopause is eradicated and older women will retain the health they enjoyed when younger. Skipping to the underlying section, this age-old belief that females are given a fixed bank account of eggs at birth is incorrect. In fact, ovaries in adulthood are probably more closely matched to testes in adulthood in their capacity to make new germ cells, which are the special cells that give rise to sperm and egg cells. And this is quite an extraordinary development. And indeed, if the menopause could be reversed and women could remain fertile for much more prolonged period of time, could radically alter the landscape of assisted reproduction, and could have treated Sari Menu if she were alive today. The other midrashic line was that Sari Menu suffered from a congenital absence of a uterus, which she could also have been treated had she been alive today. This is an aspect which we mentioned last year, and here's the development of that research which we mentioned last year, just published in February 2013, in Fertility and Sterility, the preliminary results of the first human uterus transplantation from a multi-organ donor, which means from a woman, from a cadaveric donor, from a deceased donor. Here's the woman. She looks like a firm woman, actually. It's a tichel. She's not. She's from Turkey. So she was the recipient of the first uterus transplant. And in fact, just this past year, they implanted a fertilized ovum in her new uterus, her transplanted uterus. And they were hoping that it would be successful. Unfortunately, as you see in the bottom, just a few weeks ago in May, the woman who was to get pregnant with a transplanted donated womb has had the pregnancy terminated. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen with the next or with the next. So this raises fascinating halachic issues. One of the classic, fascinating halachic issues would be if this womb which she received had actually given birth to children while the donor was alive, and now she's pregnant with a male child, would that male child require a pidyon aben or not? I'll leave that for you to think about. There is a solution to that problem. Next slide, please, Laser. And you see others have followed suit. There were two mother-to-daughter womb transplants in Sweden, and we are awaiting the follow-up on those if either of these women will become pregnant or not. This is something which we will mention in the next few slides. We will mention only briefly now. We will have reason to return to them in our session on oncofertility tomorrow, Mir Hashem. But just to share with you that there is a fascinating record in the halachic and historical literature of reproductive organ transplant in previous times to our own, which we will again develop more fully tomorrow. Another fascinating area of exciting development in beginning of life and the treatment of fertility and infertility is the development of reproductive seed. And again, I mention this just for the context here, and we'll return to it again tomorrow in our session about fertility, as this next slide as well, of testicular transplantation. This one I'd like to share with you, and I found a fascinating halachic source which bears relevance to this. And this is the possibility of having an embryo called a three-parent embryo and this is from June of just a few days ago, actually. A pro-life group has condemned plans to create offspring with three genetic parents. Now, let me share with you what the medical context here. The medical context here is as follows. DNA is found in the nucleus of the cell, and this brings back horrors of your basic biology, I apologize. But that picture on the right side shows also that outside the nucleus of the cell are mitochondria, and in the mitochondria are also DNA. Now, some people, and this is only maternally transmitted, some people bear genes in the mitochondrial DNA which can cause muscle disease, neurological disease, and even potentially fatal disease. So what the scientists can do is they can take a woman who has this mitochondrial disease, extract her nuclear DNA, and insert it into the cytoplasm of another woman. So in fact, the egg and the ultimate fertilized egg will carry the DNA, the nuclear DNA of woman A, and the mitochondrial DNA of woman B. So you have a three-parent embryo. So the question is, what are the halakhic ramifications of such a thing? Now, there's an intense debate about, which we spoke about in past conferences, about the definition of maternity and surrogate motherhood. Who's considered the halakhic mother? Is it the genetic mother? Is it the birth mother, the partition mother? And, of course, we always joke that, according to Hallmark, all mothers are considered the halakhic mothers, so you can send them all a card on Mother's Day. But from a halakhic perspective, it seems to be that many poskim now are considering the genetic mother to be the halakhic mother. Now, if you consider the genetic mother to be the halakhic mother, this presents somewhat of a challenge, because in this scenario, you have more than one genetic mother. You have the nuclear genetic mother, and you have the mitochondrial genetic mother. So if you're holding that the genetic mother is the halakhic mother, which one is considered the genetic mother? Which one has the chashivas? Now, obviously, in terms of if you're holding a higher robe, if you're going according to the majority, obviously there's far more nuclear DNA than mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA really don't have much impact. It is likely that the mitochondrial DNA would not have maternal influence, but I don't think it's at all absolutely compelling or clear. But there's a fascinating halakhic source. And by the way, the notion of having more than one parent, or more than one male in particular, contribute to the genetic makeup of a child, which is something that probably most people in this room would never think about, is something which many other cultures carry. So this is an article from Science News, who says only one sperm gets the prize? And it says, from this article about 2-3 years ago, that people in at least 18 societies around the world believe that a child can have more than one biological father. And they actually believe, and this book is called Carnival Paternity and Anthropological Theory. So the belief is that people can actually, if a woman has relations with more than one man, all the men genetically contribute to the makeup of the child. And this is a notion which is perpetuated in many other cultures and many other societies, at least expressing the idea that you could have more than one, in this case, more than one father, in our case, with the mitochondrial DNA, more than one mother. There's a fascinating halakhic allusion to this also, which is found in the Gemara in Yerushalmi. I'll just synopsize what the Gemara says for our discussion. It says that that Goliath, the giant Goliath, who was slain by David HaMelech, David at that time, was actually the product. His mother had relations with multiple women. The Gemara actually says that he was the product of 100 fathers, implying that he was actually a genetic makeup. Genetic is anachronistic, of course, in the context of the Gemara, but implying that they imparted some traits, all of them imparted some traits to this one man, Goliath, raising the possibility of partible or multiple paternity for one child. If you change the slide, please, ladies. And this was actually discussed from a halachic perspective by Rebbe Yoshi Zatzal in the sefer by his son-in-law, Zilberstein. And he writes, and he's stopping and talking exactly about this notion of partible paternity. And he's stopping Marashami Adonai Yosef Shalom and Yoshi, and he's talking about the case of Goliath. Do those 100 fathers Ha'vdin shel'av l'gabi dina ha'torah bil'ahalim. Do they have halachic status of a father or not? The 100 fathers, l'gabi yibum, with respect to yibum, with respect to if a child is born, does he inherit from all 100 fathers? Is he chayiv kibra ve'ein to all 100 fathers? If one of them, one of the fathers was a Kohen, does that mean the child is not chayiv to have a pidyon aben? And a whole host of other fascinating questions, all of which could theoretically be relevant to our real modern contemporary case of partibul maternity, not partibul paternity. Continuing along the field of assisted reproduction, this item just appeared in March of this year. Fascinating case unfolding in Israel, pitting an anonymous sperm donor against a woman who demands his sperm. As reported in Haaretz, Galit, a 39-year-old single mother living in Florida, has conceived a daughter with the sperm of an Israeli donor. She purchased 5 more samples and stored them in a bank. However, when she decided to conceive another child, she was told that the man had withdrawn his consent. After a religious conversion, he felt remorseful about allowing his sperm to be used by a woman he did not know to conceive a child he did not love. So the question is it permissible for him to retract his consent? What did she say? She said, it is out of the question for a sperm donor to change his mind. I planned a family, and then one fine day, after donating sperm, and who knows how many children he has already, he changes his mind. He changed his way of life, but what about my way of life? So it's a fascinating dilemma, debate, about whether his initial consent is valid, whether he's able to retract. Now, this exact issue, I'm not sure if it's been addressed, and that's the issue of a person retracting consent just from his reproductive seed, just from his era. But the issue of retracting consent for existing frozen embryos has been addressed in the halakhic literature. And the context here is are couples that have undergone assisted reproductive technology and have embryos that are fertilized in the bank, and then they either separate or divorce, and then one of them wants to use it for conception. Are they able to do so against the consent now of their separated or divorced spouse? So you have a machlokas here amongst the poskim, and these are just two of the authorities, one is of Shaul Yisraeli, one is of Rav Ariel, about whether you can retract, whether you cannot retract. And the issue hinges on whether the embryo is considered property or not considered property. But the aspect here is that they became partners in the fact that their seed was united. But you could argue that just the reproductive seed of the man, since it's not united with the reproductive seed of the woman, would not have the same partnership aspect as the fertilized embryo, and it makes sense that he would be able to rescind or retract his consent. But that would require a halachic shuvah. One area which is developing significantly, and I'm sure Rabbi Dina Weitzman from the Pua Institute, who we also have tremendous source of having him here to share with us fascinating aspects of reproductive technology. One area which is gaining currency in the contemporary world and is infiltrating the Jewish world at a rapid pace, or not so rapid pace, but probably will become rapid shortly, is the notion of social egg freezing. Now, we will be talking about egg freezing in a different context tomorrow in the field of oncofertility, which is not social egg freezing, but egg freezing in more medical context. And the issue here is that the woman, we talked about Sari Manu and her infertility could have been caused by menopause. So the possibility exists today for women to freeze their eggs at an early developmental stage in their 20s or early 30s, and then return to those eggs at any later stage and use them for assisted reproduction. And in the secular world, people are doing this to start their careers. In the Jewish world, we have all of us are familiar with the Shidduch crisis. There are hundreds and hundreds of women who haven't been able to find a mate, that are reaching ages that they're no longer physiologically naturally fertile. If they are able to freeze their eggs at an early stage, they could preserve their fertility for later stages. It's a fascinating technology. It's a technology which the halakhic literature is beginning to address. And here you have Dr. Rebeck, OBGYN, that began to address some of the halakhic issues. And I've spoken personally to a number of posting that not only don't see anything wrong with this, but think this is this should be condoned, obviously, under certain circumstances. But we're going to see a major change in the landscape in this area, clearly over the next decade or so. And what's interesting is that the preservation of the reproductive seed, the cryopreservation, can last for prolonged periods of time. So the currently the record for frozen male reproductive seed, which has been used to produce a child, is 40 years. And the record on the bottom right, this is from September 2012, is for the cryopreserved eggs, just the egg alone, is 12 years. And that's because the technology of freezing the egg is a much newer technology than the technology of freezing the male reproductive seed. So the question arises, this reproductive seed can be frozen seemingly in perpetuity. So I apologize. The notion of having this reproductive seed around for literally hundreds of years begs the question about the possibility of using this reproductive seed so that, you know, I know this is bizarre and it's seemingly futuristic, but not at all out of the realm of possibility, that you could have great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren giving birth to their great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. You know, ad infinitum. So the reproductive seed that is being frozen, there's no reason it can't be frozen for 100 years, 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, 400 years. So, you know, obviously, the imagination can run wild in terms of the potential uses of this reproductive seed. Should it be done? Should it not be done? Using this reproductive seed posthumously also has a fascinating halakhic ramifications in terms of paternity, etc. In what was quite a remarkable decision, past nine, about a year ago, a judge ordered a Spanish doctor to pay for child support after a failed abortion. But what's fascinating about it is the following. The judge ordered a private clinic and a gynecologist to pay $520,000. You read that correctly, $520,000 to a 24-year-old woman after a failed abortion resulted in a normal pregnancy. Normal pregnancy. So in essence, the doctor had to pay for the entire life of this child, who is a healthy, normal child, because he neglected to perform the abortion successfully. Now the question is that something that halacha would countenance? So the short answer to that is a categorical no. There's no question that allowing a child to be born, especially allowing a healthy child to be born, would not present something which the child could claim or litigate against their parents, or the parents could litigate against the gynecologist. But having said that, there are circumstances, which you see an example on the right, where children actually turn around and sue their parents. Children with severe debility sue their parents for having been born, especially if they were offered an opportunity to have performed an abortion beforehand. And this is called wrongful life. There's wrongful birth suits and there's wrongful life suits. This is called a wrongful life suit. They're not brought very frequently, but they are brought on occasion. So the question is it possible to sue for a child to sue for having been born? So this is Rav Levi Yitzchak Halperin, who writes that in general, because of our tremendous value in life, and while there is a debate in the Gemara about whether it is better for a man to have been born or not to have been born, it wouldn't be actionable in a halakhic court of law for a person to sue the parents, unless the parents were negligent during the child's gestation. So, for example, a mother who abuses alcohol or abuses drugs and produces a child with severe debility, indeed, it might be possible for that child to turn around and say that I want compensation for what you did to me, but not the scenario where they neglected to perform the abortion, and then as Hashkacha would have it, the child was unfortunately born with disability. Next slide, please. I'll drink first. My laser pointer tells me to drink first. So pain enough alone. Yeah, call me Abby Moreau.
Amen.
This is also quite a troubling entry. It's no surprise that it appeared in the British Medical Journal. For those who read the British Medical Journal regularly, it's quite an anti-Semitic, publication. That in the Lancet, the United Kingdom is a boiling pot of virulent anti-Semitism. The health ministry in Israel is to investigate claims that Ethiopian immigrants are receiving injections of the contraceptive Depo-Provera without their consent or knowledge, which is quite a frightening thing. Now, why they're doing this, I didn't investigate this further. I don't know what the issues are. The question is, from a halakhic perspective, is it permissible to subject a woman to contraception against her will? So contraception for the woman is a different halakhic issue than contraception for the man. It may not be a technical issue d'oraisa for women to receive a contraceptive pill or a contraceptive shot, but clearly to do so against the woman's consent, when a woman wishes to conceive and wishes to have children, violates, if not the letter of the law, clearly the spirit of the law. Moving into the field of the stem cell research, this is a cartoon I apologize I've used before, I just can't stop using it. It's the mother stem cell to the baby stem cell saying, you want to be a brain cell, you have to study, you goof off, you'll end up in a rectum. But there have been some extraordinary advances in the field of stem cell research. When stem cell research just started 10, 15 years ago, President Bush gave his first address in office about stem cell research, and there were lots of halakhic discussions about whether one can use a fertilized embryos or the likes, and basically the halakhic conclusions and analysis were that according to the majority of poskim, that one can indeed harvest cells. But it's come quite far since those days. Now evolving into the scaffolding and 3D printing using stem cells. So what does that mean? So it means what it actually says. It's actually a printer. They actually use printer. It looks like an HP printer. But instead of ink, they use stem cells, which are cultivated in the laboratory. And in this particular scenario, this is a child whose windpipe collapsed, his trachea collapsed, and had tracheomalacia is called, and needed a tracheal transplant. So what they did is they took the trachea and they actually formulated the trachea from stem cells using partially a 3D printer. And the notion of using this with scaffolding and to create many structures in the body, the bladder, the trachea, is quite remarkable. And you see one actually which, I think through the next slide, a couple slides down, laser, if you could... Yeah, this one I just pulled. I apologize I couldn't get anything later than this. This is from July 3rd, 2013. This is right now, researchers are trying to marry two different scientific accomplishments, growing healthy beating heart cells and growing simple hollow organs like bladders. The idea is to try to get a healthy beating heart to grow itself around a structural cell. The best shell right now is a human heart from a recently dead body. So what they do is they actually take the human heart, they decellularize that heart, leaving just the collagen, leaving just some, basically a scaffolding, and then put the stem cells of the patient on top of that so that the stem cells grow on top of that heart. In theory, if a person needs a heart transplant, they could receive a transplant using their own stem cells to feed the scaffolding. The objective of this would be that normally when a person receives any transplant, they would reject that transplant. They would need to take medications to suppress their immune system called immunosuppressive medications. But if you did what they did for that trachea, if you did for the heart as well, and you use the patient's own stem cells, then they would not need immunosuppressive medications. And it's a fascinating development in technology. It's creating livers, creating artificial ears, kidneys. So some of the potential halakhic issues, which haven't yet been discussed in halakhic literature, if a person has organs that are created from this 3D printer, let's say they have a kidney that's created from a 3D printer, they should live till 120, is there a seat of kura for these cells which are created artificially? Are there mitame, are there tumas koing for those that have that are considered avarim? So there's some other issues which might evolve from these artificially created structures. Scientists have gone so far as to put human brain cells in mice as well. The prospect of mice walking around with human brain cells or the converse is quite a frightening thing, and also makes us think about the general prospect of mixing species and what the halakhic ramifications are of the definition of the different species, which we actually spoke about to some extent last year in our halakhic update as well. For those of you who picked up this fascinating news item, one of the fascinating clinical developments in the field of stem cell research actually revealed success in none other than a Mira Rosh Hashiva. There was a Mira Rosh Hashiva, Rafal Shmulevitz, suffering from ALS, from Lou Gehrig's disease. And he actually received a stem cell transplant and had absolutely extraordinary and remarkable recovery over a few weeks' period of time, where he was literally debilitated, basically wheelchair-bound, and became active and returned to his teaching almost as much as he had done prior to the onset of his disease with the use of stem cell research. So it's not coincidence that one of the first remarkable clinical successes is on a man who spends his life learning Torah. Cloning also. We talked about the use of these stem cells in scaffolding and the tremendous development that has taken. The same technology is used with cloning. This talks about people who suffer from heart disease and heart attacks, but it said here in this entry, the prospects for patients who suffer from these conditions took a dramatic turn for the better. This is from May of 2013, when it was revealed that human cloning has been used for the first time to create embryonic stem cells from which tissue, genetically identical to the patient's own cells, could be grown. So this is the same concept, just a little different application. Concept here is you take a person's own cells and you can actually clone those cells and you can guide those cells to produce lung tissue, kidney tissue, heart tissue, and then return those back into that individual. The same concept, that person, when they receive that transplant, would not need the immunosuppressive medications, which represent tremendous developments. It's been theoretical until this point. Now is shifting into clinical. And here it begs the question about the halakhic permissibility of cloning. And that's an issue which has been discussed extensively when cloning after Dolly the sheep was cloned a number of years ago. While many people would stop short of allowing reproductive cloning to produce actual physical living clones, this is not reproductive cloning, this is just cellular cloning, cloning tissue. Which I think, according to most, if not all, postking presents no halakhic issues. The cloning has also been used for the following. Will extinction become extinct? A Harvard professor seeks adventurous woman to give birth to baby Neanderthal. This is not science fiction, this is fact. A Harvard professor is looking for an adventurous woman to give birth to a baby Neanderthal. It may sound like a plot from another Jurassic Park sequel, but the request is actually part of Professor Church's real-life plan to bring our long-extinct relative back to life. He's one of the leading geneticists who believes that his Neanderthal bone sample analysis is now complete enough to reconstruct their DNA. If he can reconstruct the DNA and begin the cloning process in the DNA, in theory, he can implant that cloned embryo into a woman who can then give birth to that child, which will answer our questions about what the Neanderthal actually looked like. Fascinating prospect. The Gershor Chaim, the Tiferes Yisrael, we saw Lipschitz, when he was writing about the discovery of one of the ancient men, the Neanderthal-like, and the Australopithecus, or would be a modern one, and many more since that time, he actually raised the Midrashic belief that there may have been worlds that were destroyed prior to our own, and our world is a new world that's been created, and these, be it dinosaur bones or Neanderthals, are actually product of past worlds. So it would be quite remarkable to bring back to actual life some of these creatures, which, at least according to the Tiferes Yisrael, were from previously destroyed worlds. This is the real reason dinosaurs became extinct. And this is the same issue: should cloning be used for de-extinction? Now, postmen haven't begun to discuss this issue, but it's the same issue as cloning itself. Does this run counter to the nature of the world, to the workings of the world? Does it fit into the general approach of the Ramban that kilayim or any abnormal mixture should be frowned upon? So if the Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted these species to be extinct, then they should stay extinct. Or if the technology has evolved to make them de-extinct, then we should welcome and utilize that technology. If you think for a moment, in the field of assisted reproduction, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted people to be infertile, then perhaps they should stay infertile. But we haven't said that. We said quite the contrary. In the Lord's of Yeshua, that we should do everything we possibly can, as long as there's no halachic problem with it. And so one of those issues is we welcome the quote, intervention into the world of assisted reproduction. We welcome the intervention into the world of treating patients who suffer at the end of life to prolong their lives and give them transplants and give them a lease on life. And so would this fall into that purview or would it not? You may have noticed this recent outbreak. This is from May of 2013. It received the Department of Health, maybe Dan Berman, can comment on the infectious disease aspect of this. And there's been a recent outbreak of measles in New York City. 34 cases of measles have occurred in Borough Park and Williamsburg. Additional cases will occur because a large number of children and adults have been exposed to the infectious cases. In this particular outbreak, I believe all of them, and Dr. Berman will correct me, were not vaccinated. That's the literature that I've read so far. That in this particular outbreak, the people that came down with measles were not vaccinated, and we've had the discussions of vaccination here at this conference about the importance of vaccination and the fact that if you can vaccinate yourself to prevent the development of disease, it's clearly a halakhic mandate to do so. And you may have seen actually another related area discussions about vaccination, about people who are trying to vaccinate. Healthcare workers who are trying to vaccinate people in Pakistan and other parts of the Arab world are actually being assassinated and killed by terrorist bombs that the Taliban is perpetrating. Now, the question you may have asked yourselves: how many people have heard of this? The people who have been killed. So, did you ever wonder why they're doing this? What's their motivation? I mean, these are honest, innocent people. So the motivation for this is that the Taliban believes that vaccination is a plot to kill them, a plot to sterilize them. And in fact, I didn't see the movie Zero Dark Thirty, but for those of you familiar with the capture of Bin Laden, will know that the way they obtained the DNA sample for Bin Laden was that they set up a vaccination booth. And they were able to obtain samples from the pseudo-vaccination booth from members of the family, which ultimately led to the identification of Bin Laden. Now, if that doesn't feed into their fears about the plot, I don't know what does. But it is this notion, which has been perpetuated for centuries, by the way. It's not a new phenomenon. Our belief in vaccination and inoculation is very clear. This is the Tiferes Yisrael dating back to the very original vaccination, and that's for smallpox. where he writes that it's clearly permitted to inoculate for smallpox, even though there's a risk involved, because the aggregate benefit outweighs the risk. And this is actually one of the cases, the first case that I'm aware of in the Jewish literature, where an individual claimed religious, a Jew claimed religious exemption specifically to vaccination. This is in the late 19th century. There was a Jew by the name of Mr. Levy, who in England at that time vaccination was required. It was legally required, and he refused to vaccinate. And why did he refuse to vaccinate? It's because he said, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't vaccinate. Jews don't receive. At that time, it was derivative from an animal. He said that animal would be a trait animal. We wouldn't receive a vaccine. It's us who has to vaccinate. And they threw him in jail. And the prosecutor was a Jew. And the prosecutor felt guilty, so he turned to the chief rabbi at that time, it was Rabbi Hertz, and he said, is it true that Jews don't vaccinate and Jews shouldn't vaccinate? So Hertz said, absolutely, categorically not. Vaccination is a proven medical benefit. It's absolutely not only permitted to vaccinate, but may even be obligatory to vaccinate to prevent from development of diseases. Let's get that to the reason. This I found very amusing. There was another outbreak, which you may have heard of, prior to this measles outbreak, and that's the mumps outbreak. As opposed to measles, in the mumps case, many of them had already been vaccinated, but what's fascinating is it spread like wildfire amongst the Orthodox Jewish community. And Orthodox Jewish persons accounted for 97% of the cases of this epidemic. So the question is why? So here's what they postulated. They postulated that at 12 years of age, with school days that are up to 15 hours long, yeshiva study is typically interactive, involving a havrusa. This is, by the way, the New England Journal of Medicine. Mumps outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish community in the United States, and they attribute the spread to the fact that the children learn that the Havrusa partners face each other across narrow tables or lecterns to study religious texts. The format is face-to-face, often with animated discussion. Frequently, several pairs of students study at a single table. Then we can discuss the fact that shluchim mitzvah and mizukim, if you're in the midst of the mitzvah, you shouldn't be receiving this kind of ill will. But it's fascinating that was their theory. One person actually postulated, this is Art Kaplan, who's a famous contemporary ethicist, that people who don't vaccinate, and if ultimately their child ends up infecting another child, they should be sued for liability. They're welcome not to vaccinate, but by the same token, if as a result of their lack of vaccination the child gets infects somebody else, then they should be taken to task. That would be an interesting unlucky discussion which I haven't yet seen. This was a case which is quite a tragic case, and this transpired over the last year or two. And this is a case of, we've talked about a number of cases of coercion and rescinding consent, but this is a case of rescinding consent which had tragically fatal consequences. And the context here was a woman who had agreed to serve as a bone marrow donor. She went to a bone marrow drive, found out to be a match, and agreed to be a bone marrow donor. Now, the way it works with bone marrow donation is they need to eradicate the bone marrow of the recipient. When they eradicate the bone marrow of the recipient, then they harvest the bone marrow from the donor, and they immediately transfer that fresh bone marrow into the recipient. So this woman had consented, but what transpired is that after the bone marrow was eradicated in the recipient, she retracted her consent. Now, it's important for you to realize, medically, what happens to the bone marrow recipient once their bone marrow has been eradicated. Can they fight any infection? Can they live? The answer is they cannot live without another bone marrow. It's a death sentence. So at this particular stage, she retracted her consent. And many people came to prevail upon her and to ask her, how could you do this? You must give your bone marrow, et cetera, et cetera. So what happened at the end of the day? At the end of the day, she still refused to give her bone marrow, and the patient died as a result. So the question is, from a halakhic perspective, turn the slide to Blazik. Can one coerce, can one force someone to be a bone marrow donor in a standard case. We're not talking about this particular case, where obviously the consequences are tragic when the consequences are fatal. So actually, Rabbi Bleich has argued that, in fact, because of the mitzvah of osamar dan re'echa, one could possibly indeed coerce someone to be a bone marrow donor, even someone who hadn't retracted consent at a later stage. We're talking about even at an earlier stage. Whereas Moshe Sternbach says that, while it's obviously a wonderful thing, a tremendous mitzvah to do, one could not actually coerce somebody. Now, whether in this scenario, once she had given her consent and retracted, you can obviously make an argument that in this case, at least from a halachic perspective, one could have possibly coerced her. From a secular perspective, even though the death of the donor is imminent, I don't think even an American court of law would be able to coerce this woman to give her bone marrow. Let's skip this one. Rabbi bans Orthodox Jewish men from taking blood donated by women, non-Orthodox Jews, and non-Jews. Do you want to vote on this one? We're all okay with that? I'm just going to let that one sit. We'll go to the next, the next page. Actually, just a fascinating comment on this. The notion, by the way, that that there is a distinction, a physiological, anatomical distinction between the Jewish body and the non-Jewish body, finds its expression in the Gemara. And the Chasam Sofer, in this passage in the bottom here, translates that into the practical. And he says that kashli smoch b'shem hara arofez manedu, you cannot rely on contemporary doctors like Afilu Yisrael. Even Jewish doctors, why? De kolmum chasom al pi sifre refuos shenatzo ade nisayim shahelim ade gufe umos ha'olam. Because their training was on bodies that were non-Jewish bodies that are anatomically and physiologically different. So therefore you cannot trust their expertise because it may not be applicable to the Jewish body. So again, more for discussion. All of these is more for discussion, but it's a fascinating line of thinking, which is not believed in a classic or contemporary sense. Never since then, it's been refuted as it is here. You know, clearly been refuted by many. Gastric bypass surgery. Gastric bypass has interesting halachic ramifications. But this entry, as I'll read to you in a minute, I think puts an interesting twist on the issue. Now, many people who have very severe obesity suffer from diabetes, from hypertension, and nowadays people are undergoing gastric bypass surgery in numbers greater than before. It presents halakhic issues. The surgery itself is risky. It decreases the stomach volume. So, for example, an impact on their ability to take kazayis of matzah, especially the Chazanish's kazayis matzah on Pesach, they wouldn't be able to eat it. So maybe they shouldn't have a gastric bypass surgery because it might prevent them from fulfilling mitzvahs. But clearly, the benefits of eliminating hypertension, eliminating diabetes, and increasing your longevity are great. But as to the benefits, this remarkable research, which I think actually makes the dovetail into the epigenetics, although not in the exact vein that Dr. Cage was talking about, gastric bypass surgery would at first seem to tackle the problems of obesity through simple physics. Let's skip into the next paragraph. New research shows that the effects may go beyond patients themselves. A study has tracked women who have had kids both before and after these surgeries and reveals that children also see changes in how their bodies handle fats and sugars. The researchers have found that the offspring may be benefiting from epigenetic inheritance in which the parents' surgery influences how the DNA they inherit is interpreted by their cells. Now that's an absolutely fascinating piece of research. I mean, I'm sure we're going to see more of this, but it's really quite remarkable. We talked about, they had a remarkable session last year on Mitzitzah. The Mitzitzah saga continues. On the issue of Orla and Mitzitzah, it even impacted in the wine industry this year. There was a remarkable entry on these wine labels, which we're talking about, Lo Hashash Shmita B'Orla. And if you turn to the next slide, you see how this is translated. It says, no fear of Shmita and foreskin. Yeah. And a great figure in the Jewish medical halakhic history died this year, but he actually wasn't even a Jew, and that was C. Everett Koop. C. Everett Koop was a major player in what was one of the landmark cases in the history of medical halakhic literature, and that's the separation of the Siamese twins in Philadelphia, where Moshe was consulted and rendered a very difficult decision about the permissibility of separating these twins. Although I don't have the exact quote here, that's the remarkable quote. In essence, he had tremendous deference for Moshe Feinstein. He said, "There is a little holy man that sits in the Lower East Side. Whatever he says, that's what I shall do." And it was a remarkable chapter in our history. Can I move on? Can flip that one. One more. You obviously couldn't have missed this development when one of the major American film stars, Angelina Jolie, was found to have a positive breast cancer gene and decided to undergo radical bilateral mastectomy. This is an issue which I believe we're going to discuss in one of our sessions, so we'll leave it for that discussion. I'm going to skip one more. another area where things are becoming popular is the issue of whole genome sequencing, sequencing the entire human genome, which is fraught with a number of difficulties, but still something which is intriguing. Does this fall into the halachic obligation of Nishmartim Olam Asher Seichem or not? Are we supposed to do genetic testing? Are we supposed to do test our whole genomes and find out if we have disease? So one support for that, which I'm not advocating at all, is this case in the New York Times in June of last year of an individual who did whole genome sequencing on himself. He's a reporter. He found out he had the gene for predisposition to diabetes. So he tested himself more frequently, and he found out probably the day or week that he actually developed diabetes, he found out he was able to begin treatment, and it will probably affect his life in the long run. So whether this will be something that will become more popular, we will see. Again, I apologize for not getting you anything later, but on the right side, from July 4th, 2013's New England Journal of Medicine, you see people are beginning to use whole genome sequencing for clinical applications here. It's for assessing uterine leiomyomas or fibroids in the uterus of women, and that will directly impact treatment. Can skip. We'll skip, and we'll just go to the end, and we'll do a list. Did anyone pick up the bad Kohanim? We'll talk about this another time. This one. There's new evidence that's come to light about the definition of the term the Yechazik Hashem, the slave Paro. They did a study on Egyptian mummies and found out that many of them had atherosclerosis. And in fact, it might be the understanding of the pasuk in Yechezkel, "V'nasati lachem leiv chadash v'ruach chadasha atein bekirvachem." I will give you a new heart. "V'asirosi et leiv ha'eden," I will remove the stone heart, which contains the plaques of atherosclerosis. "V'nasarfem," "V'nasati lachem leiv hazar," and I'll give you a new heart. Also, a reflection this year on another biblical issue, and that's Yaakov and Esav in utero. There's now a Cine MRI. You can actually have an MRI video of twins in utero to see the relationship of those twins, and see what it means to Yisroel Tzav Bonim B'Kirba. Let's go towards the okay. Here we stop here. We are. I don't know if anyone picked up the article on Ariel Sharon. So there's been a number of new advances in the application of MRI. One of them is to patients who suffer from persistent vegetative state, and they're doing what's called the functional MRI, and they can actually see that patients who were thought to be comatose are actually not so comatose, and actually have potential communicative ability. They did this on Ariel Sharon. There's a lot of halakhic ramifications on this, including end-of-life treatment. You can turn the slide laser. And how we treat the comatose patient. So some to differentiate between the comatose patients. So we might, in the future, be applying this functional MRI to patients at the end of life to help clarify our halachic decisions. It's also been applied to autopsy in a fascinating study. You can now do vertopsy, which is a virtual autopsy with MRI. And in a study published in May of this year, autopsies that are minimally invasive can determine the cause of death in babies and fetuses just as accurately as conventional autopsies. So that impact the halakhic discussions about autopsy. Why do an autopsy in the menagel of mace when you can do a vertopsy, which doesn't at all affect the mace? Next slide. And as our last slide, the other area that MRI has been applied to has been prayer. So they study functional MRI of people in the midst of prayer. And they've actually found that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, those who pray, in the midst of their prayer, the frontal lobes light up, the same areas that would be engaged in speech and language. So in essence, prayer is a dialogue. Prayer is a discussion. They found that atheists do not light up at all in that area. So if rabbis are having difficulty figuring out, the kavanah of their congregants, I would suggest, especially in the old days, find out when they could al shini, who's the heretic and who's not. So you can institute functional MRIs at all the shoals to address this issue. And to conclude, which is a quote I often conclude with, that Benjamin Franklin, which is just as relevant today as it was then, actually more relevant, the progress of human knowledge will be rapid and discoveries made for which we have at present no conception. I begin to be almost sorry I was born so soon, since I cannot have the happiness of knowing what will be known 100 years hence. But whatever it is that will be known 10 years hence, 100 years hence, rest assured that the Gedolei HaPosim of every generation will deal with those issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Reifman. As always, a fascinating journey through the year. Before I introduce my next speaker, I just want to point out, sometimes we hear stories, and we think of them as legends. So when I heard the story that Rabbi Reifman just mentioned about Professor C. Edward Cooper, the pediatric surgeon who happens to be the general surgeon in the United States, I was in a class with Rabbi Tendler, who actually told us the story. So when I heard it again tonight, when he said, "I will not operate," and this is referring to the Siamese twins, until the little man on the Lower East Side tells me to. So it's nice to know that sometimes these tales that sometimes progress and enlarge, they're really true. So quite fascinating on a personal level. Our next speaker is new to our conference, but an asset, I must say. In reading actually his CV, and in fact all of them, I don't know about you, but I certainly at the end of the day feel somewhat humbled. Dr. Alan Kadish is he's currently the president and CEO of Touro College and Touro University, and somehow also president of New York Medical College. Maybe that will share with us some of the insight on how we can juggle those. Distinguished scholar, academic administrator, a teacher, a physician. He's published over 300 peer-reviewed journals, chapter books. He's obtained his MD from Einstein. He did his postgraduate work at Harvard, and his CV is more than impressive at the very least. It really gives me a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Alan Kadish to us this evening, who will address us now with a talk on epigenetics.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here, and also thank them for having me follow Eddie's tour de force. As a novice, there are two things I have to say that hopefully I'll learn for some point in the future. One is I didn't realize there was a speaker's dress code, so I'm a tad casual. And the other is, since some of the talks are on Shabbos, there's no PowerPoint, so you'll have to bear with me without slides. There are actually going to be four parts to tonight's talk. The first part is going to be a review of a rapidly evolving field which that he mentioned, epigenetics. The second part is going to be what's a relatively straightforward part, I think. The third part is some conclusions about the nature of how the Torah views intelligence and the Jewish intellectual tradition from that Bar Torah. And the fourth part, putting it together, is fantasy. So we'll try to get done before the fireworks, and I hope you'll indulge me in the fantasy. So let me start by talking a little bit about epigenetics, because that's the basis for a lot of what I want to speak about this evening. You're all aware that every cell in the human body has the same DNA, except for the gametes. Despite that, cells differentiate, as the word is called, to form different parts of the body. So cells in the eye, the ear, the liver, all have exactly or almost exactly the same DNA sequence, but they turn into something different. What that tells us, of course, is that there's something that modulates which genes are expressed, that affects how genes are expressed. And this piece of development and change over time, of course, has been known for a long time. But what determines which genes are expressed and how that can potentially be hereditary is what I'm going to speak about tonight. So let's take a step back now to the 1800s and a famous story about science, which tells us that we need to be careful about preconceived notions. There was an argument about heredity in the 1800s between Darwin and Lamarck. And when I went to school, Lamarck's views on heredity were paraded as the height of folly. This is what happens when you're not really a scientist the way Darwin was. You believe in craziness. So what was the craziness of Lamarck? The craziness of Lamarck was that acquired characteristics, things that happen to a person during life, could affect what happened to their offspring, the genes of their offspring. Not because they influenced their offspring in raising them, but because the genes were somehow passed on. And the classic example of Lamarck's idea was that if you took the tail of a rat and you cut it off 10 generations in a row, would the next generation not have a tail? And of course, the experiment was done. The answer is no. And that sort of disproved Lamarck's theory. And everyone, of course, then accepted the theory of evolution. Now, when I talk about evolution tonight, I want to be very clear. Everyone in this room, I assume, knows it. I'm not talking about how human beings were created or how the world was created. I think it's very easy to resolve the theory of evolution with Maaseh Bereishis, and that's a topic of another discussion. But when I talk about evolution tonight, it's really going to be the idea of how organisms adapt to changes in the environment. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that the reason epigenetics is important and must be right is because evolution, despite what we were all taught in school, is not very efficient at all. Maybe evolution works pretty well in bacteria or yeast or fruit flies, but it's a very, very poor technique for adaptation for human beings. So why do I say that? The human generation cycle is about 20 to 30 years. To achieve adaptation on the part of a human being to a changing environment might take 10 generations till those genes that are selectively an advantage are brought out through natural selection, through Darwin's theory of evolution. That's hundreds of years. If the environment changes in our currently fast-paced, both ecologically and technologically changing world, evolution, which takes a couple of hundred years to affect selection of human beings, is clearly a very bad way for organism improvement. Let me give you an example of that. Sickle cell anemia is prevalent, particularly in African Americans in the United States. The reason it's so prevalent is that sickle cell anemia had a selective advantage in Africa. Malaria was endemic in Africa, and patients who are heterozygous for the sickle cell gene, meaning they have one copy of the regular gene and one copy of the sickle cell gene, are malaria resistant. If you have two copies, you're in bad shape and you die early. But if you have one copy of the sickle cell gene and one copy of the regular gene, you're actually going to be at a survival advantage in areas where malaria is endemic. The problem is Africans moved to the United States, became African Americans, and it's still a couple of hundred years later, and the sickle cell gene is still all over the place. Evolution, regardless of the issue of creation, is simply an inadequate way for human beings who have very long generational cycles to adapt to changes in the environment, like the eradication of malaria. So there ought to be a better way to do it. And in fact, there is. Two other things about terms before I talk a little bit more about that. One is, I'm going to use the term epigenetics in a relatively broad way, meaning modifications to gene expression that last for a long period of time. There was a series of exchanges in PNAS, which is probably the third most respected scientific journal in the world, earlier in 2013, which suggested that the term epigenetics was being misused in a review. But for the purposes of tonight's discussion, the broader definition of epigenetics, I think, will be appropriate and won't change very much. The second thing is, we will eventually get around to talking about the Torah's views of intelligence, and the title of the talk was given. I want to make it very clear that nothing I'm going to say tonight ought to be interpreted or will reflect the fact that any one group or race or religion has a genetic advantage. Quite the reverse. I'm going to be completely silent on that issue, but talk about how there are other things that can actually produce advantages that have nothing to do with DNA sequencing, because they're due to epigenetics. One other point about the science. When we talk about epigenetics, the question is, how is it possible that environmental factors will affect heredity? How is it possible that 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 generations down the road, there will be changes that reflect environmental influences that human beings are exposed to? We know how genes are inherited. We all remember the fruit fly experiments. How could that last for several generations? Well, it turns out there are 3 mechanisms that have now been developed and shown pretty clearly to work, not all of them in human beings, but some of them in human beings. 2 are related to maternal factors. And to try to understand those 2 things, I have to review a little bit more about how gene expression is controlled. Human genes, unlike genes in much simpler animals, are controlled in a very complicated way. First of all, most of the human chromosome does not consist of active genes. It consists of modulating sequences. There are skips in the chromosome, and even skips in individual genes coding for proteins that are put together through complex mechanisms. One of the things that's involved in those complex mechanisms are proteins that are bound to DNA called histones. So how can an acquired characteristic affect future generations? So there are 3 ways. Maternally, you can modify the histones chemically, which modifies which genes are expressed. You can modify the DNA directly through a process called phosphorylation, which affects how genes are expressed. And therefore, anything that happens to the mother could modify those genes in the fetus, and that modification can last throughout life. And in fact, as I'll tell you about in a moment, that modification can not only last through life, it can be inherited for several generations. The third way is even more interesting, and it's a way that the male parent can affect DNA expression. There's a series of experiments, the first in 2007, going through to this year, that have shown that that there's something called microRNA in the sperm. And that microRNA, those bits of RNA, which are RNAs and material that has multiple functions, we don't need to go into this evening, but those bits of RNA in the sperm can actually affect gene expression. So there are ways that things that happen to the parents, both the father and the mother, can actually affect the gene expression in offspring. So I've made the wild comment that Lamarck might have been correct. And let me briefly tell you about 4 studies that show that there's a component of Lamarckian inheritance in what happens in experiments. So I mentioned the tail idea, and the reason I mentioned the tail idea is the tail idea actually has been shown to be true, although not quite in the way that Lamarck envisioned it. There are situations in which you've got parents who've got spotted tails and offspring that have the genes for white tails that continue through several generations through epigenetic mechanisms to have spotted tails. That experiment's actually been done. The results are very clear. Things that the parents experience can be passed on to future generations and affect tail color. Tail color is not very interesting, but I've learned something in reviewing this that I didn't know, that chickens actually that are used to lay eggs and for food are very different than chickens that exist in the wild. Not surprisingly, the ones that lay eggs are twice as big. They lay a lot more eggs. They're actually much more docile. So it turns out it's very easy to do the experiment to take a wild chicken and a chicken that's been domesticated and try to see what happens. And what's been shown is that when you mate those two, you can have the characteristics of the domesticated chickens that last for eight generations, even though the DNA of the wild chickens is still there. How does that happen? The factors that the mother is exposed to are passed on to the next generation through the mechanisms I talked about. So those things are interesting physical characteristics. But what we're talking about tonight is the potential for modulating learning and intelligence. And so the question then becomes, physical characteristics we understand, is it really true that behavioral characteristics can actually be transmitted? Well, it turns out that the chicken domestication experiment that I told you about does include a component of the behavioral characteristic. There's a very clear test for how docile the chickens are, and that behavior is inherited. But there are two experiments that have been done, one in suicide victims in humans, and one with a little more detail in rats, one published in 2012, one published in 2013, that show that child abuse during adolescence and growth affects DNA expression much later in life. And the more interesting experiment done on suicide victims is there were particular regions in the brain that 30 or 40 years later were still modified through the mechanisms that I described with DNA phosphorylation, which were very different in those suicide victims who had experienced child abuse and those who didn't. So although this is not transgenerational, yet it's evidence in human beings that behavioral modification, not just physical characteristics, can lead to genetic changes which can last for 30 or 40 years. So to summarize, I'm not suggesting that evolution is not true. Of course, evolution as a theory of selection and adaptation, not of creation, works to some extent. But there's been very clear evidence that continues to explode in 2013 that suggests that acquired characteristics, both physical and behavioral, can be passed on to future generations through these epigenetic mechanisms. Why is that important in regard to what we're going to talk about tonight? Because tonight I'm going to provide you a theory and or fantasy, depending on the way you want to view it, of about how the Jewish intellectual tradition can be transmitted from generation to generation, apart from genetic factors, and how it can even last for several generations. So with that scientific introduction, I'm now going to skip to trying to understand the Jewish intellectual tradition through the focus of an analysis of the Torah. And being an experimentalist in some of my past life, I decided to take a very straightforward experimental and empirical approach. If we look just at the Torah, not at all of Tanakh, and try to find where the Torah refers to intelligence, we find the word chachma used about 30 or 40 times in the Torah. And of those 30 or 40 times that the word chachma is used in the Torah, well over 50% of those references refer to one individual. That individual is, of course, B'Tzalel. And in discussing the characteristics of B'Tzalel that led him to be able to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan, the Torah uses the word chachma over and over again. So I thought that if one wanted to try to understand what the Torah is teaching us about intelligence, that we probably should look at those characteristics that Torah ascribes to Bezalel that would be useful in helping to understand intelligence. And there are five different terms that are used to describe Bezalel in multiple Pesukim. If you recall, the story of Bezalel is actually told at least twice. Once when Hashem describes Bezalel to Moshe, and the second when Moshe describes Bezalel to the rest of the Jewish people. And there are some differences in those two descriptions. But four of the key elements of those two descriptions are preserved in those two accounts. And those four things are Chachma, Bina, Das, and then Chachma Slave. And rather than trying to translate those, I'll describe what the Rishonim tell us about those four characteristics in just a moment. The fifth one is interesting. L'horosnas anbelivo, the ability to teach, that Hashem does not mention to Moshe at all, but this is a case where Moshe added something on his own, as we have several other cases where he did, perhaps in Shloshishim HaGbalah, perhaps in other areas. Moshe decided that Hashem's four characteristics that he described to ascribed to Bezalel were inadequate, and he had to add a fifth one, which is the ability to teach. So what are these characteristics? If we start with Rashi's relatively straightforward description of these characteristics, and that, if you look at the source sheet, is, let me get the right number here, because I've got a different number since I've had slides. It's reference. It's section 10. The Chachma, Rashi describes, is Masha Adam Shomeh Me'acherim V'Lamad. Intelligence, or Chachma, as it's classically described by Rashi, is something that you learn from other people. Memorization, learning things from others, it's the first aspect of intelligence that's described. Tehuna, Rashi describes, is Maven Dabar Mi'libo Mitoch Dabarim Shalomad. Understanding things in his heart based on things that he learned from someone else. And the final of the first three descriptions, Das, is Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, is how Rashi describes Das. Now, different Rishonim describe these three characteristics a little bit differently. If we look at reference 11, you can see that Chachma is described by, this is Rav Avram ben Arambam, very similarly to the way Rashi does, as is Tevuna. But Das, he describes as Hashlimus HaSichli Seyotzeis Min HaChachma Tevuna. Das is some sort of a superego that incorporates both knowledge and creative thinking. There is, of course, an entirely other approach that I printed some references about later, a more Kabbalistic approach to Chachma, Bina, and Das. But for the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to stick to the traditional explanation of the Rishonim, Chachma being knowledge that one gains from others, Bina being understanding, and Das being some cognitive summation either influenced by Hashem or influenced by human intelligence under the inspiration of Hashem. Now, the fourth characteristic, Chachma Slave, is interesting. And if we look at reference 13, there's a fascinating drasha that the Ramban wrote for his own Chasana, where he talks about the machlokas, the argument in the Gemara, about where intelligence comes from. And if we look just at the underlying piece in this reference, Rabbi Elazar Omer Chachma Barosh. Rabbi Elazar says that intelligence comes from the brain. Rabbi Yoshua Omer Chachma Balev. Rabbi Yoshua says that it comes from the heart. And he uses a pasuk in Mishlei, the Ramban uses a pasuk in Mishlei, to try to reconcile these two views of where intelligence resides. He says, Shachachma Barosh, Umisham Mitpasheses Balev. intelligence begins in the brain and spreads to the heart. And the pasuk in Mishlei is Hat Oznecha Ushma Dibrei Chachamim V'Libcha Tashis L'Dati. Beginning, intelligence beginning in the ear and the head, and then spreading to the heart. I want to suggest an alternative explanation of Chachmas Lev based on this Ramban, which as Chachmas Lev is the ability to actuate through the rest of the body, the heart. As a former cardiologist, I feel very comfortable saying the heart being the center of the body, and that which actuates everything else that happens, that intelligence begins in the brain, but then spreads to the body, because another aspect of intelligence is the ability to take your creative thoughts, to take your intelligence, and actually accomplish something with them, rather than making it a purely theoretical exercise. And of course, in referring to Bezalel and the creation of the Mishkan, no one in Bnei Yisrael was interested in Bezalel's theoretical conception of what the third Beis HaMikdash would really look like. What Bnei Yisrael and Hashem were interested in is finding an artisan who could actually bring everyone together, incorporate art, design, architecture, chemical science, and the science of the day, and create a living, breathing Mishkan. So the final characteristic that Moshe then ascribes to Bezalel, which wasn't in the first description of Bezalel, is ulhoros nasan b'libo, the ability to teach. And without reading too much in the way in the sources, if we look at source 15, v'yomer ha'kosef the Koheles im hayoso chacham mufla. Koheles, Shlomo HaMelech, was a tremendous genius. In addition, the pasuk says that he had a separate intelligence, which is the ability to teach. And if we look at reference 16, Nachshoni sort of reemphasizes the same aspect, which is skula nosefes bo al kos skulos hadigulos yeshol ka adam omer hakasam sofer. There's a person who may have a great deal of intelligence, but he doesn't know how to teach. So no matter how smart someone is, the Rishonim and the Achronim Chazal recognized that the ability to teach is a separate sort of characteristic. So if we try to put this together and tell us what the Torah is viewing intelligence as, or put another way of, if we had to define a Jewish intellectual tradition based on the Torah, what would it look like? I don't want to suggest, by the way, that any one of these things is unique, because each of these things may be shared by many other cultures and societies. But I think the constellation of them is in some ways unique. So the first thing, before we look at the specific psukim and what I believe their implications are, is that it's a very broad view of intelligence. That is, the different characteristics that Bezalel required to build the Mishkan included not just science and math, but it included the ability to work with the materials that were available, to use chemistry, to use art, to use design, to use architecture. The Torah has a very broad view of intelligence that it's describing as it describes Bezalel. So what does that consist of? One, chachma, a tremendous respect for precedent. Clearly, even though Hashem could have imbued in Bezalel throughout HaKodesh, the way he imbued in Moshe how to make the menorah, he could have imbued everything about the Mishkan. He chose to do it in a different way. He chose the selection of someone who had chachma, who had accumulated lifetime of knowledge from other people. This respect for precedent is an intrinsic part of the halachic process. It's the intrinsic part of everything that we learn that later generations can't disagree with prior generations. And this tremendous respect for precedent is somewhat unique in the Jewish intellectual tradition, because standard scientific methodology suggests that more recent advances always are ones that have a greater degree of validity than prior knowledge. It turns out that I can provide several examples from scientific literature how a respect for precedent resulted in scientific advances that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. There are two outstanding examples in the work of physicists, one Albert Einstein and one Witten, where they look back on work that had been done 50 to 75 years earlier and made what arguably are two of the greatest advances in the field of physics in recent history. In Einstein's case, the theory of special general relativity based on some math that had been done in the 1850s, and in Witten's case, multiple dimensions buried in a single atom based on some work that was done in the 1920s. But the one that I can actually talk about with some degree of intelligence is a cardiology example. And that cardiology example is what causes a heart attack. So when I went to medical school in 1977 and took cardiovascular pathophysiology, what I was told is that heart attacks were due to progressive atherosclerosis. That is, there's a narrowing of the artery gets narrower and narrower and narrower until it completely occludes, and that causes a heart attack due to lack of blood flow to the heart. The reason that was assumed to be the case is because in the 1920s, pathologists who did autopsies and found clots in the arteries that were feeding the heart decided that those clots were post-mortem clots. In about 1910, people, based on early autopsies, thought that heart attacks were due to thrombosis. But the pathologists in the 20s and 30s got much smarter, and going all the way to 1977, when I learned pathophysiology, that was still thought to be the case. It turns out that 3 years later, or actually 2 years later, when the work was done, it was published in 1980 in the New England Journal of Medicine, a cardiologist looked back at this earlier literature and decided that, despite the fact that it was ancient in medical terms, that it had some validity, and he had the boldness to do cardiac catheterizations on people who were having heart attacks. And what he found was that essentially everyone who was having a heart attack had a clot. And of course what that did is it ushered in the area of thrombolytic therapy and then angioplasty, the ability to open the artery feeding an area that had a heart attack and completely change the prognosis of heart attacks in the United States and throughout the world. And so that's the kind of idea of a respect for precedent that's extraordinarily useful in scientific research as well as in other endeavors. That's a unique characteristic of the Jewish intellectual tradition, and in fact probably the one that's most in contradistinction to what I would call the general degree of understanding of intellectual tradition today. And if you look at the way learning is developed between the Rishonim, between the Tanoim, Amoraim, Gaonim, Rishonim, Achronim, and perhaps post-Achronim, if you believe in that characterization, it's very clear that that idea of respect for precedent has been promulgated as part of the Jewish intellectual tradition. The second aspect of Tzvuna, or the ability to think for oneself and understand, is very, very clear. Despite thousands of years of learning and tremendous respect for precedent, one of the things that's characteristic of yeshiva education throughout is the idea that we encourage everyone to come up with a chiddush. And no matter how much we respect what's been done before, no how much memorization occurs, the idea that we ask someone to come up with a chiddush has been promulgated for a great deal of time. The third aspect of Das, and I'll sort of interrupt for a second to try to explain why Rashi and Rav Avraham ben Arambam have this unique characterization of Das as based on something that Hashem has provided, which is that if you look at one of the only other places where Chachma is referred to in the Torah, it's referred to Yosef. In talking to Paro, Yosef doesn't refer to Das, he only refers to Chachma and Tzvuna. In Chacham ben Avon Kamocha is Paro's response. And so the idea is that someone who didn't believe in Hashem, who thought he himself was God, understands Chachma and Tzvuna, but doesn't understand Ruach HaKodesh or Das, which is why it's referred to in describing Bezalel, but not referred to in describing Yosef. But how do we generalize the idea of Ruach HaKodesh or divine inspiration or a wholeness of intelligence in some fashion, one of the spheros of intelligence, so to speak, as applying to a general Jewish intellectual tradition, even for people who don't believe in Hashem or don't believe in God? And I think the fundamental idea here is the idea is that the application of intelligence and understanding has a higher purpose. Whether that purpose is building the world to be a better place, whether that purpose is believing that Ruach HaKodesh is there, whether that purpose is that Hashem put us here for scientific and other advances. The idea that we have a purpose other than pure intellectual curiosity or self-aggrandizement in our intellectual endeavors is something that I think encourages intellectual development, encourages intellectual creativity, and encourages advances. The fourth piece of Chachmas Lev I pretty much referred to earlier, which is the idea that intelligence itself is great, but whether you use that intelligence to teach the next generation of Torah scholars by teaching yeshiva, whether you use it to create a mishkan, whether you use it to create scientific advances, whether you use it to create beautiful art, that intelligence was given to us with the idea that we'll produce something with it, that it creates something. It's not there just to be beheld as a work of beauty. The final piece, Ularos Nasanglibo, has at its roots the idea of education in the Jewish intellectual tradition. And you're all aware of the fact that although universal literacy wasn't always universal in the Jewish intellectual tradition, it certainly was much closer to universal than it ever was in any other intellectual tradition. There's a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization about a bunch of monks in Ireland who copied Greek and Roman manuscripts when everyone else in Europe was illiterate. But the Jewish people, although there were certainly exceptions, by and large never had that problem because everyone learned how to read, at the very least, even if they didn't understand everything they were reading. And universal education, universal literacy, was always a key part of the Jewish intellectual tradition. So, with that, we can pass to the fourth part of the 12th part that I'll call fantasy. So what am I going to postulate to you tonight? I think there is clearly a Jewish intellectual tradition that has a unique set of characteristics which are cultivated by learning Torah. That unique set of characteristics actually has, in my view, its origin in Bezalel and the description of Bezalel, of what the Jewish intellectual tradition ought to look like. And although there are some stretches in a couple of places, if you look at what yeshiva education is typically like today and what it has been over the millennia, it has many of those characteristics that Hashem describes as cultivating Bezalel's intelligence. What the epigenetic piece of it is, and how that relates to the topic, is the following. What the epigenetic data, particularly the data from 2013, have shown is this effect of education could potentially be transmitted apart from any genetic differences for multiple generations. It does attenuate eventually. In most experiments, although chicken domestication is exception, in most experiments, epigenetics tapers off after 3 to 5 generations. You all know the data. About 30% of the Nobel Prizes in science and medicine in the past 100 years have been won by Jews. Mostly Jews who themselves may not have come from the Jewish intellectual tradition, but whose parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents possibly did. And what I believe is at least possible is that the unique success of Jews in intellectual achievement and in other areas of achievement may be related to the idea that intelligence has been cultivated for millennia. And whether or not there are any genetic differences, I'm not going to discuss. But epigenetic activation of intelligence, just as behavior can be modified through child abuse, through domestication, or through education. And there are data about education, IQ data about education, how groups of individuals who have poor IQs, parents who have poor IQs, when their children are educated young, IQs, whatever you think of that as a measure of intelligence, tend to revert towards the norm rather than remaining deficient. I do believe that there are biologic changes introduced by education, sort of the converse of the negative changes introduced by child abuse. that could potentially be cultivated and result in permanent changes in gene expression throughout one's life. But the data I've described to you tonight suggests that those changes in DNA expression, not necessarily in DNA sequence, can actually be passed on for several generations. So the good news is we've got an intellectual tradition which cultivates intelligence, not just for the sake of mitzvos, not just for the sake of learning, but for the sake of what it can produce. It's a rich intellectual tradition, a tradition that's lasted for millennia. It's been modulated by interaction with other traditions, but some of the key elements have persisted. And I think it's resulted in a lot of good. That's the good news. The bad news is that epigenetic changes do attenuate. And after 3 or 5 generations, they'll go away. And so we've got to continue to try to keep the Jewish intellectual tradition alive for those who remain firm and observant, and for those who don't, to try to make sure that this unique advantage we have, apart from anything else, doesn't attenuate and go away as time goes on. And with that, I'll close in time for fireworks. Thanks for your attention.
Rabbi Reichman to the front, please. So first of all, thank you very much, Dr. Kadish, for a fascinating topic and something to think about this weekend. We have some time before fireworks. The schedule will be that we will daven Maariv at, 9:10. So we have an opportunity, if anybody has some questions that they want to have our speakers entertain, to keep the floor open. Anybody, any questions?
That's a question for Dr. Reichman. We all giggled at the slide about the rabbi suggesting that we shouldn't have transfusions mentioned have from women. Is it really meant to giggle at, or is there something in there that we should actually hear? Ruff said it. Should we have some respect for it, or is it a bit...
I'm glad you mentioned it. I think there's probably both sides of the coin for that one. There is clearly that line of thinking, and I don't mean to belittle that. I was perhaps, and I admit guilt, tried to invoke the giggle, but maybe that was inappropriate. I should ask him a tefillah for that. There is no question that there is that line of thinking. But however, it seems that the majority is pretty dismissive of that. And believes that there really should be no distinction whatsoever, especially between Jew and non-Jew, in terms of donating or not donating blood, in terms of the ability to save a life. What is interesting, and your comment actually reminds me of it, and I didn't intend on mentioning it, is that there is and I don't know if there's published literature on this, it's clearly anecdotal literature, that especially receiving transplants, that people who receive transplants, and this may be, I don't know if this is an epigenetic or genetic phenomenon, sometimes adopt the characteristics and behaviors of the donor. I don't know if any of you have heard this literature. So, for example, someone all of a sudden finds that they love hamburgers, and they never loved hamburgers before after they received a heart transplant. And it turns out, you know, when they finally meet the donor family, that the donor had a passionate love of hamburgers.
So I wish you'd use a different example than the hamburger. Transplant atherosclerosis is a big problem.
Bad example, sitting in cardiology. But so I guess, you know, even though, you know, there's a philosophical notion, but one can't minimize the fact that there may be an impact on receiving blood or organs from another person, which could have a long-standing impact on your life. And even, for example, receiving DNA, sort of Moshe Paskin, that it's better to be to receive a donation from a non-Jew, and that the gene, the actual genetic material, the person's progeny should come from a non-Jew. He didn't necessarily advocate it. He said from a theoretical perspective. A lot of people gave pause to that because there's no question that it has a significant impact.
There is a case of bone marrow transplant with male recipients. that there's statistically a difference in survival if female donors are used versus male donors, and that the male donors result in better transplant statistics. To the point where programs like the National Marrow Donor Program and the British and German programs are now emphasizing recruitment of young males rather than
very interesting.
Yeah, so just to follow up on the answer that you just gave, so you probably know the rest of the story, but got a minute or two. So the specific issue that you were talking about was the issue of non-related sperm donation for, this was actually goes back to the early 1960s. And this question of does the genetic material matter actually turned into a machlokas between Rav Moshe and the Sofer Rebbe. The Sofer Rebbe was very upset by the idea that you would use non-Jewish sperm for artificial insemination, and wrote a very caustic tshuva about the fact that someone in his community, having read Rav Moshe's initial tshuva written in 1963, went ahead and became pregnant. And so he really felt on the genetic side that this was a serious issue. And there, as you probably know, there are now a couple of cases dealing with Kohanim and other things where Zera Yisrael, the idea of what the origin of genetic material is, may have some halachic impact.
Yet we accept a Ger Tzedek as a brother. So how could that be? How could you reconcile the two?
So once somebody becomes a Ger, the epigenetic mechanisms change things all around.
About a month ago, in the New York Times, a woman wrote a letter about her own journey of becoming a mother. She took a egg from a donor and had a baby, and was talking about her experience of how she wanted the child to be as much her as possible, and then she heard that the rabbis in Israel were saying, or wherever it was, were saying that the genetic mother is more than the mother, and it stemmed into a whole conversation and comment about how crazy religion is, that they can say that one mother, that the mother is the first to a child, is not the real mother. How would we, I guess, face these sort of arguments or discussions?
There's no easy answer to that question, and there are two parallel dialogues that are going on. There's the purely halakhic universe, which necessitates a definitive approach to whether a person is halakhically Jewish or not halakhically Jewish. And then there's the epi-halakhic or supra-halakhic discussions about what motherhood means. And we obviously acknowledge that there's a notion of paternity and maternity that expands beyond the genetic. Adoption clearly is a tremendous mitzvah, and the adopted parents have a scar as if they've raised a child. Clearly is beyond the genetic because the Torah believes that the Ger can, the Ger Tzedek can become a full Jew. So the genes do not make the Jew. Yet at the same time, you have to have definitive halakhic responsa, which address the needs of the halakhic community about who constitutes a Jew and who doesn't constitute a Jew, who constitutes a mother and who doesn't constitute a mother. So there's no easy answer, and there's no consensus. And it's an evolutionary process, and it's really perhaps more so than many other halakhic issues. It's challenged the halakhic world and evokes more emotional response than many others.
Comments, questions? Well, I think we're good. Question?
I'm not sure if the cardiologist mentioned it, but seems to the cardiologist developing the idea for the
Marcus DeWitt.
Jewish.
He was not Jewish. The two physics stories were, but as I said, I would, if I tried to talk about string theory, we'd be here a long time, and everyone would probably be a lot less well-informed than I. That's simply an example of precedent, although he wasn't Jewish. Most cardiologists are.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank our panelists for this evening. For what we'll do is we'll stay right in this room. We'll daven Maariv. Perhaps if I can have the men come on to this side, we'll daven Maariv, and then immediately, and then we can hear the fireworks. Thank you. Did anybody leave a phone?